Hello and welcome to Series 1 of the podcast The Heart of Teaching, produced by Hibernia College. My name is Aoife Lynham, teacher and researcher, and in this podcast I speak with educators from a variety of fields and ask them about the teachers who inspired them to get where they are today. So join us as we meet the inspirational for a little bit of inspiration. So today I'm delighted to introduce Marita Cairn. She's Assistant Professor in the School of Education in Trinity College Dublin. Marita is the Course Coordinator for the Bachelor in Music Education and she's also a qualified primary school teacher. Marita, I'm delighted to welcome you here today. Thank you so much for being here. So I suppose since we're talking about the heart of teaching, it's a nice one to begin with to just ask you why you actually decided to become a teacher.
And you know, it's a hard question because I can't really remember, Aoife, giving it much thought. It was almost like I always knew I was going to be a teacher. And I kind of, as I look back on it, it's probably because I really, really enjoyed school. I love the traditions. I love the culture of school. I love the camaraderie of the friends. I loved all my teachers. I love the colours, the smells, everything about it. So from way, way back, I was excited about going to school the next day, so excited I could hardly sleep. And that stayed with me all my life through teaching. Another reason was I learned to teach long before everybody else. I learned to teach with my own grandmother. And she would look after our family in the summer for 2 or 3 months. And she was, first of all, she valued education. But the second thing she did was she was very wise in how she taught us things like, you know, numeracy and literacy. We played cards with her. And then when she saw we could play a game, she let us play together. And then she taught us how to write our name. And how she did that was she would give us the same gift each, like it could be a notebook. And she'd say, put your name on your notebook. And so there was a purpose to us doing it. And after a while, then she'd sort of up the game a little bit. And she'd say, put your sister's name on her notebook. And she'll put your name on her and exchange gifts and things like that. She bought the evening paper and we did puzzles. And we sent off the puzzles and we won money. And then as we got older, she had quiz books. So Granny seemed to, I used to think for a long time, her focus on teaching was literally on instruction. But then I encountered Vygotsky and I thought to myself, Vygotsky has theorized what my grandmother was doing. She was placing the learning in an authentic setting by teaching us cards. She was creating zones of proximal development. When she saw that we got so far and we needed encouragement, she intervened. And she had very clever ways of doing that. She seemed to know that we learned in a kind of a social context, that we learned from being together. And learning wasn't separate to our lives. It was part of our lives. And she seemed to know all about this idea of mediational means, like if we knew we were going to win something, we were very quick to do the puzzle on the paper. So long before I went to school, I think I became a teacher. And then when I went to school, the teachers very quickly gave me jobs like teaching the boy beside me who didn't understand the Humpty Dumpty maths book. And I loved that because it was the only way I got him to talk. And then later on, I taught other kids in the class how to read. And that gave me a great buzz. So I think it's really from all of that that I knew, you know, this is something that's very natural and it seems like I'm okay at it. And the other thing was the other two jobs I could have done were nursing, you know, in a hospital. I was never happy in hospitals. Administration, I was really, really bad at administration. So like it was the kind of thing that I thought was most natural for me. And that's really, I'd love to say I went into teaching for some lofty ideals like that I would like to make a difference in the world or make a mark. Long after I was a teacher, I learned the importance of the job. I didn't know it going into it.
And that's great, actually, because I would imagine that many of our audience will be student teachers. So yes. It's good for them to be aware that, you know, you do develop over time and you learn more things as you go on, that it's not in college. Exactly. You're going to learn everything you need to know, that you will develop as time goes on. I was going to ask you, who was your favorite teacher? But now I'm wondering, was your grandmother perhaps your favorite teacher?
You know, it's quite hard again to pick out who's my favorite teacher because I loved all my teachers. And I loved them all for different reasons. But my favourite teacher was Mrs. O'Dea. And she was possibly the only lay teacher in a school full of nuns. I think looking back on it, the reason I really liked her was because everybody liked her. And I think the reason everybody liked her is she had done some living. And she was able to tell us about meeting Paddy Kavanagh on the canal as we were doing Leafy with Love, you know, the canal bank walk. She brought it to life. But then she taught us Livy for Latin and she didn't live at the time of Livy. But you could bring those wars and, you know, that time in Rome to life. She was very interested in, as a class, everybody getting a B or an A. And if somebody was trailing a little bit behind, we all had to stop and wait. So she saw this whole corporate learning thing, that we learned from each other and that we had this kind of devotion to each other and to us all learning together. So she was an interesting person. She was smart. She was extremely caring in a kind of a Nell Noddings way. She cared about her profession. She cared about all of us. And she loved the weak child, the one who didn't get it. And she loved to ask us, any of us in the class, to understand how she could make it easier, how she could make it better. So we learned to explain complexity, you know, through her as well. She was extraordinary. She really was extraordinary. But they were all very good, Aoife. All my teachers were, one after the other. They were fascinating people. My piano teachers then were, I mean, they were just amazing altogether, you know. So I just have been really, really lucky with marvellous teachers. Blessed, really.
That's great. Yeah. And was there something or a trait that you, or did you emulate any of these teachers yourself when you were teaching?
Eventually, I think I began to, but it took a while. Mm-hmm. So I think as I'm like reflecting on Mrs. O'Dea now and thinking about the beautiful characteristics she had, where my sister, who really wasn't academic at all, loved her and loved the feedback, the personal feedback she gave everybody, you know. And I think the value she placed on us all. I definitely became that teacher much later, but it took me a while to realise that where I learned that actually was from her.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
Because I think even what you're talking about is a lot to do with how teachers make you feel. Because a lot of what you're describing is
exactly.
Remembering how she made you feel.
Yes.
And, you know, things like that. I think that's so
important.
And how
she felt about her subject.
Yes, the passion that she had for her subject.
And how she felt about her profession, you know. She gave it everything, really.
Yes.
Know? Yeah.
And was there then, I suppose, any challenges along the way? Was there anything challenging throughout your career? Anything you'd do differently looking back?
The greatest challenge for me was qualifying. So when I qualified in Mary Eye, I'd had a couple of years of what I thought was a very ordinary kind of level of scholarship compared to the Leaving Cert, because the Leaving Cert was challenging. And then Teacher Education College was, you know, very, very manageable. The Mona Muncha, all this teaching methodology and all that kind of thing, to me was common sense because I had the natural ability to teach. That wasn't a challenge. The challenge was when I qualified as a primary teacher and I got my first job and I found myself in a location where there was very little money, there was a lot of hardship. I hadn't encountered anything like that before and I felt totally ill-equipped for the junior infant class that I had. So I searched for quite a few years for answers to the problems. I didn't even know how to articulate the problems, but I knew from knowing the backgrounds of the little kids that I taught that I wasn't meeting their needs. Mm-hmm. And it was nothing to do with not being ready to teach. I knew the kind of resources that would interest them and I could take their minds away from the trauma they were going through for a little while. But I knew I could see them daydreaming again and I knew they were troubled and I actually did not have the resources. I didn't have enough living done to harvest, to bring into that situation. So I found myself very low during that point. And I think there's a whole study now called praxis shock or something like that, where teachers who are ideal and come out into an ideal world. And I think by the time I was finished in Mary Eye, I actually was ready to make a difference to the world. I was kind of fired up. But luckily for me, when I came to the end of Mary Eye, one of the lecturers there who had a great gift of knowing where we were going to be, suggested that I would do a degree in music because it was something that I felt passionate about and organised that I would, while I was teaching my first job, study music during the day as well. So I finished teaching the junior infants classes at half 12 or 1, and they went home and I scooted off my bike into college and the lectures were on for the afternoon. That sustained me. And again, in retrospect, I look back and think, how did I get through the 3 years that I taught in that school, knowing inside of myself I was a fake, I was a fraud. I got through whatever you call those exams or at the beginning, you know, the teacher exams we do with the inspector for the first
the
couple
H-dip,
of years.
Was
the H-dip
it?
Or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
I got through those and no problem. I mean, I wasn't excellent. I was just a very good teacher, solid teacher who prepared. But in my heart and in my head, I was desperately embarrassed by the standard of response mm-hmm. I was giving in the classroom.
Okay.
The music distracted me. It was wonderful. It filled my soul. It filled everything about me. The people I studied with were marvelous. When I finished, I decided I'd leave primary teaching for mm-hmm. that reason, that I felt I wasn't meeting the needs of the kids. Mm-hmm. I had a choir in the school. The school was very sorry to lose me. But I decided I'd do a bit of travelling. So I went to West Africa, and again, the same thing happened. I found myself in the bush dealing with kids whose background I would never have imagined, mm-hmm. who gave a round of applause to teachers who turned up.
Well.
Where the principal had to go and spend the weekend and sometimes longer begging for a payment for his teachers in the school, you know, where the students had to bring water to the houses in the morning to wash. And again, it was the joy that these kids got out of life and out of learning that kind of made me think, wait a second, I do have something to give. Mm-hmm. So I taught English and French there, strange enough, not music, but I had found the resources to teach them. So that puzzled me as well. I thought, now I can find what I need for this particular setting, which seems amazingly deprived and culturally very different, in books, because that's what they valued. That's mm-hmm. what they wanted at that time. So I had a wonderful time for 3 years or something like that in West Africa, various different countries. And then I found myself in the States in a completely different milieu, different mm-hmm. culture again. I found myself with affluent Episcopalian Americans. Mm-hmm. And again, I found this great gap in what I could offer. Broken marriages, children that weren't picked up until late in the evening, a lot of neglect. Mm-hmm. Again, I felt this panic. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't actually help them. Mm-hmm. And that went on, actually, for the time that I was there. And it only took me returning to do the formal H-Dip in Trinity okay. to see could I learn more that made me realise that all those subjects I was doing in Mary I, the philosophy, the psychology, the sociology, didn't mean anything to me then, and I did them through Irish. When I studied them, having lived the experiences I had for 6 years or whatever it was, I was actually ready now to find the answers to what I was looking for. You know, so
yeah, I think that's really
journey.
Fascinating.
Yeah,
because I feel the same a little bit now when I read about philosophers and when I look at the psychology of education
yeah.
that I perhaps didn't appreciate as a student teacher.
Exactly,
but now
yeah.
I find myself only at the weekend I came across this really good book and it synopsizes 50 of the top philosophies around the world. And it just really, I'm looking at Rousseau and I'm looking at all
Beautiful.
These people that
yes.
I learned about in college, but that perhaps didn't appreciate. But now I'm looking at the research that I'm doing and seeing how that relates directly to it.
Yeah, it's kind of finding application for that theory.
Absolutely.
And for me, it's no more than looking back at my grandmother and realize that she was onto Vygotsky. She was living the same time as him. But she was a woman who walked to school in her bare feet, who carried a potato to keep her hands warm and who ate it for her breakfast. How did she know how to teach us?
Yes.
And I'm thinking it's only on reflection I realised that. And the same with Rousseau and all the others that we read about. It's only when we see an application for it that the thing becomes meaningful.
Yeah. I think that's actually quite reassuring for student teachers, because that a lot they're over it, particularly with the PMEP programme. It's 2 years and there's a huge amount of information being fired at them. But then
yeah.
to remember that actually keep that in your toolkit. And, you know, as you
Absolutely.
Progress throughout your career, it's going to become more
exactly.
and more
exactly.
relevant
Don't lose
to you.
Them.
Don't lose it.
Yeah,
exactly.
Exactly. Yeah.
You've mentioned there a lot about, you know, the different cultures and then also your passion about music. So I suppose looking at in Irish schools now, there's a huge amount of cultural diversity that mm-hmm. may not have been there maybe 20 years ago. So how can we use music to maybe make the classrooms a bit more inclusive? What would you say to student teachers out there?
I suppose the first thing I would say about music is music has been used in education, you know, for quite a number of things. It's been used to build up a nationalistic kind of a fervour in the 1920s and 30s, whatever it is, you know, to develop the Irish language, to prepare for liturgies on Sunday and to bring spirituality to the school. So I suppose my interest in music is slightly different in the sense that I'm interested in music for the authenticity of the mm-hmm. subject itself. So I suppose I find it very hard to see a use for it mm-hmm. without, first of all, dealing with, I suppose, the power of music mm-hmm. and the power music has to reach parts between our hearts and souls that we don't otherwise know exist until they're filled with music. And how do we do that? How do we bring music to the school? When you ask then, how do we use music then in that particular context? We can actually do what we've been doing up to now, sing songs from different cultures. We can invite in the parents and they can teach the songs of these cultures, you know, to other children in the class. We can ask them. We pay, in a way, to me, that's paying lip service mm-hmm. to diversity, because there's so much more to culture than just music, but music is a very much important part of it. So to answer your question, I think what we need to do is really look at partnership, which is a very big thing at the moment, collaboration. And if there is a father or mother or a granny, you know, who's got a song and who can come in and teach it from her heart to the kids, mm-hmm. I think the other kids in the class are likely to understand a little bit about the culture of the child from Romania or wherever mm-hmm. they're from, or from, you know, Poland or whatever. Without that authenticity mm-hmm. in teaching, I think it might just be mm-hmm. lip service. So, like, we can tell stories of a little kid going to school in Poland and see what's different about their lives mm-hmm. and ours, you know. And so we can sing a song in Polish and we have a couple of words. But in a way, what are we doing? You know, what mm-hmm. are we doing in terms of promoting an understanding of another culture? Mm-hmm. Now, we can look at style. If you see, we've been working for a little while with a school in the north side where the students who are musicians in Trinity partner with the primary school teacher. I think that's been very successful because we have the two expertise. We have the beautiful complementary expertise of the primary teacher, who at the beginning didn't know what they were doing in the room. And you have the expert musician who goes in, takes out the oboe and plays. And you might say, but there's no place for an oboe in this classroom. None of these children, they're only junior infants. None of these children play oboe. But actually, the teacher then relates the stories of how she has been so surprised to see the kids sitting at the end of their seats in total wonder. This is the first time for a lot of them they would have heard a live orchestral instrument. And they're just absolutely transfixed. Everybody learns something. So the students obviously learn something about the oboe. The student teacher who's a musician would have thought, but there's no place for an oboe in the music classroom, really. I should be teaching them about Mozart. But actually, what they want is music. They want music in the classroom. And for the teacher themselves to say, gosh, I didn't think the children were capable of dealing with an instrument like the oboe, but yet they were. So, you know, it has given us all a lot of, I suppose, understanding about learning, about music, the place of music, and most of all, about the vital role of the primary school teacher. And how this works is it's like what we call co-teaching, which is a way of pairing teachers with different expertise in order to meet the learning needs of the kids in specialist subjects. It started in the States, actually, with special education, first of all. During mainstreaming, where there was a special education teacher, the teacher, instead of going for coffee, stayed and picked up some of the techniques of the specialist teacher. And the specialist teacher picked up how the teacher was relating what they were doing to the general population in the classroom. And then this guy, Michael Roth, took it on as a way of dealing with science and maths and the problems they had in the States with not having experts in those subjects, falling grades in that. And again, he found by bringing in a scientist to the classroom, you need the teacher because the teacher can translate the expertise. So we thought we'd do the same with music, and it's worked really well, Aoife, you know.
That's fantastic.
I would love to do that for every school in Ireland, but we don't have enough musicians.
Course,
in Trinity,
yeah.
but there are enough in Ireland.
Absolutely, you know, and that's a great tip actually to anyone listening to reach out to your communities to reach
Absolutely.
Out and invite
and as
these
you said,
experts in. And
yeah, and the expert could be, you know, a Romanian granny.
Absolutely.
It could be an Italian granny. It could be, you know, a Russian uncle or
yes,
something like that.
Yeah.
But I think the skills of co-teaching are particular and they're finite as well. It's about being curious. It's about being open to collaboration, about mm-hmm. asking questions and scaffolding the other person to tell their story properly and to get it across and then continue with it, embedding it in the kind of conversations that go on in the classroom, you know. So I think, you know, once a teacher is trained on that sort of like that little skill set, I think one of the teachers said to me recently, you know, even when the guard comes in to talk about the safe cross code now, we co-teach.
Okay.
I'm so pleased to hear that, you know, instead of falling asleep, the teacher knows about this, but still, you know, engaged with the guard and kind of the guard or whatever, you know.
That's fantastic.
Yeah,
that's great.
And continue during the week then to remind the children what the guard had told them about safe crossing mm-hmm. and that kind of thing, you know.
Wonderful.
Yeah. So that's a nice kind of piece of research that's coming out of Trinity. I think a few places have that idea now of complementary expertise, you know, but it's powerful.
That's very powerful.
Yeah.
And are there any other resources or websites or anything for music that you would really recommend to anyone listening?
I suppose musicians tend not to use finite sources like that. Mm. But because I deal with the student teachers and they need help starting off, I mean, they need a little toolkit, as you were calling it there, Aoife, to go out into the school. They can't just go out and take learning to the degree that they have it and sort of package it for 4-year-olds, mm-hmm. you know, without having some help. A resource that I think is very useful is one that was devised by a graduate of Trinity College, Shane McKenna, and it's called Dabbledee-Doo Music. And he has franchised that. He spent a long, long time, himself and another guy, can't remember his partner's name now offhand, but they have spent a long time developing a programme from junior infants right up to sixth that is delivered through franchised schools. So he will go in and train the teachers, first of all, and show them what it's like. When I say train them to use the resource, which is a web resource. And then he will rent that through a franchise, the school, for a year. You know, and it's interactive. It's built with the primary school curriculum in mind. And it has an assessment tool in it, and it's terribly fun-based for the children, mm-hmm. and again, it uses technology. Mm-hmm. The teachers who've used it continue to use it over mm-hmm. and over. You know, he has a way then of linking with the teachers and offering professional development if they need him, if the music gets too hard or whatever it is, you know. So he seems to have ticked all the boxes. So I think that's a very, very good one. And then there's Keol Ireland. You know, they have quite a few little resources and books and that sort of thing that I hear from schools. When I ask them in the primary school we work in what resource they find useful, they tend to say, well, we have the right note and we use that little book, but we kind of forget about it after a while. You see, songs like language die. They're a living part of the tradition, you know. So for me, the greatest resource for music in the class is the student. And when I started working myself, I went with my kind of like my resources and my worksheets and all that shit. But I realised, you see, music is just so powerful, really, that the type of music that speaks to the student mightn't necessarily be the type that speaks to me yet. It will eventually if I let my student have a voice. Mm-hmm. So I think to start with where the students are at, if they're into Disney, you bring them in the Disney song. So what does a teacher do then? Because a teacher might say, well, that's just entertainment. Mm-hmm. The teacher needs to look at the curriculum, which is wonderful. The music curriculum is wonderful. And look at those nine elements like, you know, melody, rhythm, beat, tempo, texture, timbre, structure, style, all those things that sound a bit vague in the beginning. But actually, as you unpack them, I hate using that word, but if I do, cliche word. But as you kind of like, you know, grapple with them, you realise they're not actually that hard. So you can say to the children when they've finished listening to their song about Princess, whatever her name is, what did you like about the song? Mm-hmm. And they'd say, because she's a princess. And then you realise that's not really anything about the song, though, in your head. Mm-hmm. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
So what does the song tell us about princesses? And then they think again. They'd say, she liked to do magic. Oh, and if there were no words in the song and we just listened to it, no words at all, what would the song tell us about magic? And you're getting to the instrument that there might be a xylophone or something like that, indicating.
Excellent.
Yeah, that you're kind of pulling it away. And then when you're not getting any further, you might say to them, you know, was the music fast or slow? And they'd say, it was really slow. And say, so the tempo was really slow. Why do you think the music was really slow? Because she was just a baby princess and she couldn't really walk very fast. Things like that. So the teacher, through questioning, brings the child to a critical understanding of the music that appeals to them first.
That's lovely.
Then little by little, you introduce your music and you bring them to an understanding of why you value that music. Because it's funny, the principal of the school I work in is just so wonderful. I've just such high regard for Principal Ziva. I feel they should be paid the highest CEO salaries in the country. They're just amazing people. But the principal would say to me, now, Marita, make sure the music is culturally relevant. And for a while I would say to the students, guys, will you just make sure the music is culturally relevant? And one of them said to me one day, what do you think she means by that? I said, actually, I don't know. So I said to her, what do you mean by make the music culture? And she said, oh, they only love pop songs and things. So I told the students and they said, but isn't that a crime? Like, you know, if all of our teachers told us we only love pop songs as well, how could we have ever got to know anything else? So I go back to her and say, you know, the students think we should bring in Mozart, we should bring in Tchaikovsky as well as. She said, oh God, I can't see them being that interested. But actually, after a while, she came back to us and said, I can't believe what the children are saying to me. Mrs. whatever your name is, whatever it is, you know, we listened to a Tchaikovsky piece today. And then as she asks them about it, they're actually able to articulate what they liked about it. So you can actually, by creating these zones of proximal development again,
absolutely,
bring the children. And why would we deny them this beautiful music?
Couldn't agree with you more, because I remember I worked in disadvantaged schools, and during art, instead of, because I used to find when they'd listen to pop songs, it would kind of change the atmosphere and you want them to feel relaxed. So I used to put on classical music and Mozart and Tchaikovsky and everyone. And they in the end used to be like, that's very calming music, miss, you know.
Exactly.
So they used to, without even realising it, you know, they were actually responding to the music. And then that's how you bring it then into your lessons. And I think it's a lovely
beautiful.
Way.
And then I've seen that, Aoife, and I've also seen another lovely experiment too with where the student teachers are out and they would have the children lying on the floor listening to it, because the teacher does that. And then when they wake up after a little thing, they'd say something like, what did you hear in the music? Now, the first day, the children would have heard nothing because they were too busy dreaming. It's like yoga, you know, where you're too busy wondering what you'll do next to enjoy the moment. And the next day, they say, what did you hear in the music? And it took quite a while before they heard anything. And then they actually shortened the music to kind of like only a few seconds. What did you hear? And then they eventually heard amazing things in the music. And then what do you think the composer was trying to say? You know, things like that. And then what was it about the music that made you think that? You know, because they often say, oh, I think the composer was talking about his dad because maybe his dad got a dog. And the story is nothing at all to the music. And say, but what did you think about, how did the music tell you? Let's listen to it again. Did anybody else think it was about a composer and a dog? Then somebody else, no, I think it was about. So eventually you bring them back to what is it about the music? Just like you'd say with the picture, what's the picture about? And if they see Red Riding Hood, they know what it's about. But if it's not about Red Riding Hood, it's just a splash. And that's equivalent to really classical music. It's just a dot on a page, you know. It doesn't make any sense for quite a while, you know, until eventually somebody says, I think that's a reaction. Mm-hmm. What do you mean it's a reaction? I think somebody just flung something in anger. So you think there's an emotion, yes, in the painting or whatever it is, you know, that you can wait and see what they come up with. It's in them. It's really, that whole educare thing is so true. You're actually bringing what's in them out through the types of questioning. And that's actually really difficult as well. It takes us a few years to get that right.
Okay.
So you just spend time with the music yourself or whatever, and then the questions follow.
Lovely. That's really, I feel like I want to go out tomorrow teaching.
I know, it's wonderful. Again.
I suppose for future teachers, what would your main piece of advice from your experience at primary school level, at third level education, if you had one piece of advice to give them, what do you think it would be?
I suppose it would be the one piece of advice in different ways. Maybe the first one would be keep your mind active. Mm-hmm. Seek out CPD that enriches your soul. A lot of CPD and keeping the mind active for primary teachers tends to be about what do you bring home and teach the kids now. But actually, I think having a rich mind and having, a broad mind and a mind that encounters great writers, you'll bring them home much more than just the technique or the ability to do something better. You know, you'll bring home an understanding of humanity, which I think enriches the classroom. That all sounds far too lofty. What do I mean by that? I mean, don't think of yourself as a teacher. Think of yourself as an educator. And I mean, don't lead a small life. Lead a big life. And I mean, don't think of teaching because of the value that society puts on it right now, money-wise, as something less than it is. It is a truly heroic profession. And I would think that the advice I would give a young teacher is to think like that. Never, ever lose sight of the impact of a wonderful teacher, because you could have the most wonderful classrooms in the world, but it's the teacher that makes, all the research will show you that, the teacher makes a difference. So I would say read, read and read. And the advice somebody gave me in the States actually when I studied there was always have by your bedside Hello magazine, because you love reading it anyway. And there might be nights when you're just tired and you want to look at pictures. Have by your bedside a great novel. And keep your eyes and ears open. You know, check websites to see what are the novels, the New York Times and that sort of thing. So I have beside me at the moment a most beautiful novel called Americana by a Nigerian writer. And of course, it's set in Nigeria that I'm familiar with. I call her Chimmy because she's got a long name, Chimaba something. Adichie. She's actually coming here next week now. And she's talking at the festival, book festival. But I have that for a kind of pleasure. But then right beside, I have a whole lot of other books. I have a book by Parker Palmer, The Courage to Teach, and I dip in and out of that. I have Maxine Green, who's the most beautiful philosopher. She taught in Columbia College and died very recently, age 96. And I read her writings, and I'm just totally enriched by those. And some others, and I'm sure I'll think of them. Vygotsky, of course, is there as well, because I'm just interested in the fact that he seemed to know what my grandmother was thinking. I love that. I love that correlation, you know. But, and then I would have other little, like you mentioned there, you know, Rousseau and Plato and Kant and all these lovely writers. And I try to make sense of them, you know. I might read The Elegance of the Hedgehog because, again, it's set in Paris, a lot of philosophical stuff going through it. And I go back and read that over and over again. I think of how really wise that old woman was who was a concierge, you know. I mean, maybe it's unbelievable, but it's beautiful. What she has brought into that book is just beautiful, her whole philosophy of life. So my advice to young teachers is keep building your philosophy, keep in touch with great thinkers, and keep confident that what you're doing is the most important job, I think. I can't think of anything more important, especially primary school teaching. Secondary school teaching is very, very important. There's no doubt about it. But primary school teaching is, my God, it's heroic. Those who do it right. Those who do it right.
Absolutely. You know? So if I was to summarize your heart of teaching, would it be that it's creating that safe environment that you talked about with your favourite teacher.
Yeah.
And creating that sense of security and awe and being, knowing your content, knowing your topic, that would it also be bringing that passion for a subject? That would it be like your grandmother and looking at Vygotsky and looking at those great thinkers and that instead of kind of going in and devaluing what we're doing, that we continue to recognise that it's the most important thing that
absolutely
we can do.
I think you've really summarised it very well, Aoife, and that word safe is very important. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what I loved about primary school teaching as opposed to secondary. Secondary was a different kind of a buzz, a wonderful buzz too. But primary teaching, you could create for a child who came from any kind of a home that morning, for a few hours in the day, you could create magic. You could create this security. And the other thing you could do is you could build up this lovely esprit de corps in your class. And then the other wonderful thing I think that happens in the primary school is, because primary teachers are awfully wise, really, and it's no harm that the points are high for going into primary school teaching, because you need to be wise. But and I suppose half of that comes with experience, of course, but we've wise people going into it, which is a good start, is identifying in each child in your class what their gift is, because we all don't have lots of gifts. We've some. So a primary teacher at a very early age, because they're not invested in making one child into a doctor, another into a something else. They're invested in getting to know the child, but actually being able to let the child know, like my teachers did, you're good at teaching. Mm-hmm. And then somebody else, you're good at bringing kindness. Mm-hmm. And say, but the mother might say, but what's that got to do with anything? Well, Charles Dickens, who was very wise, was forced to write to the in-laws of his son to be, of his son, and to say to them, my son came home and told me he was going to marry your daughter. May I tell you at this point that my son is a man of very humble means, but he possesses a quality that is so rare. He is the kindest soul. Isn't it lovely?
That's lovely. I know. We're both going to be emotional here. But that is inspiring.
He says, the kindest soul I have ever met. And he said, he will look after your daughter for the rest of it. I mean.
And that's what we want.
Yeah. So if you find a kind child, that has to be able to say to them, your kindness. Mm-hmm. Somebody else who's a child who's organising the room. And you might say to them, tell us how you organise everything. Mm-hmm. Because it's just wonderful. Tell her how important it is to have her in the class. So I think identifying what the children's gifts are, you know, it's just, so, and the children to feel that their gift is valued so that they don't have to have somebody else's. They're not competing. They're collaborating because together, I mean, that's really what primary school is. That's the gift that is the primary school teacher.
And that's the heart of teaching. And I think it's a lovely one to finish on, that actually what's so, so important is that maybe we don't always focus on the academic. That
absolutely.
You focus on all the other wonderful attributes that these lovely little pupils have
absolutely
in our class.
And the academic is very important. And I think maybe I didn't stress that enough. It is very important that a teacher has core values and that those core values are aligned with the curricular expectations. But not to be limited to that.
And it is limited if we only focus on that.
It's limited. And I think it's only teaching if that's what we do.
Yes.
Whereas the other is educating.
Yes.
It really is. Because we're educating children to understand the value that they have themselves, the gifts they have themselves, but also the value of the gifts of others. You know, and that's really what it's about. So it's about less competition and more collaboration. Actually, there was something we were talking about earlier that I might finish on as well. And it was about if I had a magic wand. Remember you were saying that to me? I thought it was very interesting. I thought, if I had a magic wand, what I would do, I would invest in teachers. And what I would do is put piles of money aside for professional development. I would allow them to have free master's courses after 7 years. I would give them some time off for that, you know, things that they would bring back to the classroom. And it needn't necessarily be something that they can implement right now, but just something to help them to grow.
Yes.
And something that a little space, like whether it be a master's course or some kind of thinking like that, where they could reflect on the 7 years that are just over, because we do lose a lot of teachers.
We do.
After 3 or 4 years.
Yes.
And I think of myself like
and
that.
And I think of myself too.
Exactly. Exactly. And we weren't what they call refugees from the classroom in the sense that we saw something better. It was actually we sought the answers to problems that we encountered in the first few years. But wouldn't that be wonderful if
that
we had money to put into, we'll call it professional development, but it needn't necessarily be the narrow focus on professional development, a kind of a wider focus on professional development.
Yeah, and professional development and reflection.
And reflection.
That's lovely.
Absolutely.
I think that's lovely.
Aoife, thank you for
You're
and
wonderful.
Good luck to all your teachers.
Thank you so
much. And I just hope looking back after, I mean, I'm almost ready to retire now, but like looking back after 40 years or close enough to it, that every teacher who goes into it would say to themselves, if I were to start all over again, what would I do? Mm-hmm. And without doubt, I would be a primary teacher. Without doubt. There's no doubt in my mind. There isn't a hesitation. There isn't a weak note in that. And it's wonderful then to think, why, look back and say, why is that the case? Because I know there are some people that leave teaching, they've young families and everything. The case was that opportunities are presented for reflecting and learning on the way. I managed to take, and they were what sustained me. They were what gave me the wisdom then to go back and do it a little bit better. So I would hope that all of your teachers would encounter opportunities to keep learning throughout their lives and to keep moving on and on and on, you know. And, you know, just wish them luck.
Thank you so much. You know. Great.
Thank you. Thanks, Eva.